Welcome to Vox Talks, a series of audio interviews with leading economists from around the world. My name is Ramesh Vaitalingam, and today's interview is with Professor Charles Kalamiris from Columbia University. Charles and I met in London in February 2014, where he was launching his new book, co-authored with Stephen Harbour, called Fragile by Design: The Political Origins of Banking Crises and Scarce Credit. At the heart of the book is an attempt to understand what the two authors call the puzzling pervasiveness of dysfunctional banking. And I began by asking Charles what he meant by this.
Yes, I think that's a good place to start. Let's talk about two dimensions of banking performance, which we take as sort of the key dimensions that you'd think banking systems would want to achieve. One being abundant credit available on a competitive arm's length basis. And the other would be stability of the credit system, that is, avoiding collapse of the banking system. I would think this is not rocket science. And that's why it's so puzzling that there's such a pervasiveness of dysfunction along both those dimensions. That is, the rule in the world is inadequate credit, and the rule in the world is banking instability. The exception is stability and abundance of credit. By the middle of the 18th century, we knew how to construct what are still the basic foundations of a commercial banking system. Clearinghouses, a line of credit facility, deposits bearing interest, all these things in the context, let's say, of a branch banking operation. So a diversified branch banking operation delivering credit, lines of credit, deposits, these are things that we've had now since Scotland in the mid-18th century. It's not rocket science. So how come we can't create abundant credit? The Scots were also a relatively stable banking system. You'd think that with that model that many people were looking at and imitating, that by now we would have had it figured out. But the problem is not a technical problem. It's not a problem of knowing how to do banking. It's an ability to do it. And so the key insight that we're bringing to this is that at the very beginning, you have to recognize that banking cannot be constructed in some vacuum. Banks are constructed as political animals, very much out of their relationship with the state. Banks are chartered by the state. Banks get their rights to operate and the rules under which they operate by the state. The state will decide who gets to be a bank, who gets favored access to credit from the bank. When losses occurred, who's going to bear those losses? And the state will have to decide those itself as a conflicted party. So, for example, suppose that you're the state, in this case, England, and you're fighting the French from 1688 until 1815. You're going to have to provide for the funding of your war effort. Until you do that, you can't do much else. So it's not surprising that in England and Wales, the state saw the function of the banking system from 1694 until the end of the Napoleonic Wars as primarily to fund the state. So that explains why, at least in that one episode, you could have the one dysfunction, which is a scarcity of private credit. It also helps to explain the tolerance for instability, because part of the deal, the Bank of England was constantly under pressure, especially after the end of the Napoleonic Wars, to give up its monopoly rights. And they were ceded gradually in 1826, 1833 especially. But as that process was happening, the bank was trying to, and even before the early 19th century, the bank recognized that part of the process of fending off challenges to its monopoly charter was to have a fairly permissive discounting of inland bills. That was, in fact, a sort of moral hazard problem. And many people who've studied the banking crises that were quite frequent in the UK prior to 1866 have emphasized that the Bank of England's own discounting policies contributed to that problem. But they've also recognized that it had a political foundation. So when we just start with a very simple phenomenon of the monopoly of banking within England and Wales prior to 1826 and the instability of the British banking system, but especially when I'm talking about that, I'm talking about the English banking system during that same period. What's interesting is it's obviously a political phenomenon. That same kind of story, of course, the story changes as you go from country to country. But I think you find at the core, whenever you find dysfunctional banking, what you're finding is a natural sort of understandable political process. No one would think of the fact that the Bank of England was given a monopoly for all those years as reflecting some sort of stupidity or dysfunction. It was simply a predictable outcome of a political process in which banks were chartered for particular purposes at a time when a country was involved in a life and death struggle with the French. It lasted a very long time.
So the prevalence of banking crises essentially emerges in your analysis from the political system, the constitution, the set of political institutions. Part of your book is a comparison between two neighbouring countries that one of which you say has had a very stable banking system with, for the most part, abundant credit, and one of which has had abundant credit for the most part, but where banking crises are endemic, namely Canada versus the United States. Can you elaborate on that that contrast?
Actually, you know, we organized some of the discussion of the book very much along these lines because it's one of the more salient comparisons. We have, of course, five countries that we're studying in the book. Canada and the U.S. are only two of them. But the pairing is particularly, I think, clear when you look at it. The U.S. has had 17 major banking crises since its first one in 1792. Canada's had zero since the 18-teens when its first bank was created. Canada is a country that specializes in primary commodity exporting and continues to do that. It's inherently more volatile in terms of its GDP than the U.S. So there isn't any natural reason in terms of the fundamental structure of the economy, what they produce, that Canada should be such a stable banking environment. In fact, it's a less stable, exogenously less stable macroeconomic environment. The key question then is, well, why is Canada different? So the first sort of obvious layer of the answer is, well, they've had a different structure of their banking system. So for most of U.S. history, the U.S. was running a so-called unit banking system, whereas Canada, from the very beginning in the 18-teens, has been running nationwide branch banking. But of course, the U.S. knew about nationwide branch banking. In fact, the Bank of Montreal's charter was, to some extent, modeled on that of the Bank of the United States, the Bank of the United States predating it by a couple of decades and coming from the United States. So it wasn't that the U.S. didn't know about branch banking. And by the way, everyone was already knowledgeable in both countries about the Scottish experience. So you can't tell sort of simple stories to explain things on that basis. In fact, as late as 1910, after the Panic of 1907, when the National Monetary Commission was formed, they commissioned books on all the major countries, several books per country in some cases, including in Canada. There were three volumes, I think, on Canada. And the people who wrote these volumes clearly understood that the thing that was driving U.S. banking instability was the fragmented structure of the American banking system. Notice that the National Monetary Commission did not try to change that, because it was politically off the table. In the U.S., under our Constitution and the way it evolved politically, individual states controlled the structure of banking within their state, and banks were not able to branch across states. What that meant was that you had a banking system that was very fragmented. Why the states didn't permit branching within the states or try to work to allow the national government to create a nationwide branching system is the key political question. The answer seems to be that a coalition of the unit bankers who benefited from local monopoly rights of a very sort of one-office localized banking system, in coalition with landowning farmers who liked having banks who didn't have outside opportunities on whom they were depending. As we explain in the book, this can be understood as a sort of insurance arrangement, by the way, where if you're a soy farmer, if the price of soy declines, your land values decline, and you might have a hard time borrowing from a bank. To the extent that that bank has no opportunities outside of being located in a soy-producing area, the bank is going to be more accommodating of that decline in soy prices. And so you could see why this kind of alliance would make sense. So once you've decided that the rules of the game are going to be structured under the U.S. Constitution, there's going to be this evolution of states having control of banking, and the outcome is going to be, for the most part, this unit banking outcome, reflecting a coalition, political coalition, of landowning farmers and unit bankers who are restricting the development of nationwide branching, despite the fact that everyone on the planet, other than the Americans, has long since figured out that this is a good idea. And I'd say the Americans have figured it out too, by the way, that it was a good idea in some sense. That is, that it served the overall interests of the country in terms of stability and abundance of credit to have had it. But that's not how bank regulation's done. The way it's done is coalitions are formed, a political battle is waged, and there's a winner and a loser. And if you're the winner, you get the gains, and you can get those at the expense of others. So manufacturing interests, of course, in the U.S. very much would have benefited from a nationwide branch banking system. Also commercial interests, because in Canada, shipping things for over long distances is done much better with a branch banking system using bills of exchange, which were very rare in their use in the United States. So there's a long story to be told, but it wasn't that people didn't know this. People writing books as I mentioned, the National Monetary Commission, they knew it. So then the question is, okay, so we've already sort of gotten it. Why the U.S. tolerated this for so long? How did Canada avoid this? Is it that they just didn't have these same populist pressures that the U.S. had? The answer is no. They had them. In fact, the same kinds of people who were advocating unit banking in the United States tried to get, and almost succeeded at several points, tried to get a prohibition of branch banking and the establishment of unit banking. But they kept getting defeated. And it was, in fact, the same sort of agrarian interests that were pushing for it. The key structural difference in the Canadian Constitution is the Constitution aggregates all economic decision-making power in the national government. That's a first very important thing. Because once you've done what the U.S. did, it makes it very hard to have national policies toward banking because the banking is being determined by individual states. They would have to coordinate in a way that's unlikely to happen. Consolidated power is very important, but then the other thing is you have to structure a system that's relatively immune to the influence of factions. The key thing there was, first of all, dealing with the threat of the French. The British recognized very early on that the French were trying to block the development of Canada, particularly the building of canals. And there was no other way, if you were going to develop the west of Canada, to develop it then to use the St. Lawrence Seaway to get to the Atlantic Ocean, which was, of course, the center of the world economy at that time, the so-called Atlantic economy. The French realized that, that is the French Canadians, realized that they had this sort of geographical blocking power that wasn't, of course, relevant within the United States because you had the 13 colonies all lined up on the seaboard. And so there was a sort of political jousting going on over would there be expansion inward? How else can you attract immigrants into Canada if you don't have economic development possibilities? And you also need to have democracy. People from Britain aren't going to leave to go to Canada if it's an autocracy. Neither are people from the U.S. who are migrating into Canada in the early 19th century going to do that if it's an autocracy. So the Brits were faced with a very difficult situation early on, which was after they conquered Canada in 1759, they had a country full of people who hated them. They had to figure out how to get development to take place, to convince those people to allow canals to be built, and to have enough of a democracy that would encourage people to come there. But at the same time, if it was too democratic in the sense of being subject to majoritarian tyranny, then the French would have simply blocked everything from happening as part of their negotiation to try to get independence for Quebec. And so they figured out to construct a constitution that was centralized and that also diluted the effect of the French on voting. The Senate became, ultimately, that was the initial effect of the 1841 union of Lower Canada and Upper Canada, which was to dilute the French influence and basically create a unified, centralized Canada. And then by 1867, with the full Canadian Constitution, after bringing in many of the other provinces, the main way that the Canadians achieved that was that the Canadian Senate, which was and is still appointed by the Queen, would be a sort of veto gate toward any kinds of extreme populist pressures that would be happening. So the combination of centralization, the dilution of that initial French influence, the successful transition toward democracy, and then the Constitution 1867 with the appointed Senate were all part of a constitutional plan to keep Canada from being invaded by America, from being taken over by the enemy within, we call them the French, and to be a place that's hospitable still, being a democracy, to immigration. And that's where the Canadian Constitution comes from. It comes from the problem of trying to manage Canada under all those threats. You know, Canada was not an exogenously dull place. It was an endogenously dull place by constitutional design. And that was a very fortuitous political evolution from the standpoint of developing a banking system that would serve the national interest.
It feels like the way you explain the origins of a banking crisis in deep political issues that it's very, very hard to come up with any policy proposals to suggest this is how we deal with banking crises in the future. Would you agree with that?
We agree with that, and we explicitly say so. In the last chapter of the book, we sort of deal with this problem. And we don't think it's hopeless. The way I would put it is, it's not something that economists are going to be able to fix for you. It doesn't mean that it's hopeless. I'm still trying. As I say, you know, yes, I think that the problem is, once you understand that these things have deep political roots, if you're in an equilibrium, in a political equilibrium, you can't very easily get out of it. Politicians, after all, are just intermediary of ultimately very powerful coalitions. At the same time, I don't want to be completely pessimistic. First of all, let's point out that societies are capable of learning. Democracies are capable of doing things that are relatively intelligent. For example, in the 1970s, Britain had very high inflation, very low growth. Margaret Thatcher's policies, which are now, as you know, have actually been applauded even by the Labour leadership. What were they? Well, let's have privatization of property. Let's have lower marginal tax rates. They were confiscatory back then. Yes, it makes sense for housing to be privately owned by people themselves. So these things, which at the time were fairly radical, were ultimately adopted and are now considered very mainstream, even by the parties that opposed Thatcher at the time, by the leaders of those parties. That was actually not a easily foreseeable outcome. You know, there's a famous Scottish philosopher whose name eludes me, but he and many other people predicted back in the 17th and 18th centuries, and of course the Greeks had predicted this back in the ancient times, that all democracies would end in tyranny. Because once you get majority control, the majority will always use its power to basically transfer resources from a dwindling minority. And then once you've already gotten rid of all of the other people's money, then there's going to have to be a tyrant who takes over. That sort of pessimism goes back a long way. People have been saying that about democracy for a long time. But that's not what happened here in the 1980s in Britain. What happened was the median voter elected Margaret Thatcher three times, and not to do things that were particularly easy or not always what you would call particularly popular, at least among large segments of the population. That's very interesting. I think that that's what we need to remember before we get too pessimistic, that very high inflation is very unpopular. Low growth is very unpopular. And at some point, there are alignments between the interest of the median voter and the society's interest. That optimistic tale, of course, doesn't necessarily apply to thinking about something like banking regulation in the U.S. today. So I'm fairly pessimistic that you could say that the coalition that gave us the subprime crisis is not a viable coalition going forward. That's possible. In particular, the urban activist groups that were part of that coalition have lost one of their prime means of leverage, which is the banks have already merged. So extracting the political benefit from the banks as the quid pro quo for supporting their mergers is no longer relevant. And yet what we've seen in the last few months with various programs in the U.S. is trying a new way to intermediate that same coalition. I think that it's not so obvious that the U.S. is going to learn from the subprime crisis to actually limit the subsidization of real estate risk and to impose credible prudential regulatory requirements on the large banks to really end the too-big-to-fail problem. Those would be the sort of obvious lessons, right? We should stop subsidizing risky mortgages, and we should impose prudential regulations that are going to take us off the hook for the too-big-to-fail problem. I don't think we'll be able to eliminate the unwillingness to allow large banks to fail, but we can certainly keep them very far away from the failure point. So those would be the obvious things to do, but there really isn't a lot of political will for doing that, and the banks, I think, continue to have, and they see ways to continue to preserve powerful political allies. And, you know, the best political allies are people who hate you, because that kind of political alliance is not a partisan alliance. It's bipartisan. It's immune to electoral problems. And one of the things I think is quite interesting is the deeper you probe into banking in the U.S., the less partisan it appears. It is true that the Democratic Party was sort of all in on this game that was being played, having to do with the activist groups and the GSEs. But a very large proportion of the Republican Party was also involved in that. The GSE Act was passed under the first President Bush. And although President Clinton, of course, magnified it, the second President Bush magnified it even more. Newt Gingrich was quite responsible for allowing this all to grow and become important. So it's very interesting to note that the way also I think political scientists sometimes think about the formation of coalitions, they think about political parties as the key to the formation of coalitions. Well, that's true among people who are like-minded, finding ways to do little trade-offs. But on some of these bigger issues having to do with the banking system, the most important coalitions back in the old days when it was the unit bankers and the agrarian landowners, that those were not people who naturally liked each other. The mega bankers and the urban activists are not exactly cut from the same cloth. Those are the best kinds of political allies to have. And I think that we're not seeing the end of that yet. So yes, you know, it's a long-winded answer to your question. I'm not that optimistic about how much ideas coming from economists are going to really penetrate.
That leads me to one final question that I wanted to ask you, which is your book takes very much a storytelling approach, really. It's narratives about what went on in explaining the histories of these five countries you looked at. This is quite different from the way economists tend to approach trying to understand banking crises, which stands outside of history and tries to build a structural model which looks at cause and effect. How do you see the relation between these two approaches?
Well, they're complementary, aren't they? I mean, you have to do statistical analysis, and you have to have the discipline of economic theory informing how you're going to do that statistical analysis, but then you also have to step away from it a little bit and actually look at what's happened in the world. One of the remarkable things is if you just look at what's happened, it's not so hard to do. It's not so hard to figure out what's going on. And it also, at the end of the book, we have a chapter called Reality is a Plague on Many Houses. And one of those houses is banking theory. And so when you look at reality, one of the other things that happens is that you recognize some deficiencies in where banking theory has been going for the past 20 years or so. We've done a great job of formalizing our understanding of the potential fragility of the banking system. But we haven't done a very good job in the theory of explaining why that potential fragility is conditional. Where are the country subscripts in those models? They're not in existence. In other words, yes, banking is potentially fragile. You could, let's say, look at any one of a number of interesting articles that have been written in banking theory and say, oh, now I understand why banking crises can happen. And yet, those articles don't explain the workings of industrial organization that can prevent that from happening, or the workings of politics, which is really the true overarching force that guides all these things. So, you know, when we look at, let's say, Canada, there were threats to banking fragility constantly. There was a Great Depression in Canada that was more severe in some sense than that in the United States, but there wasn't a banking crisis in Canada. That was absolutely related to the structure of the banking system in Canada and its greater diversification across the whole economy. So industrial organization of banking was actually quite important for stability. What about politics? Well, the politics which creates effective regulation in Canada has been absolutely crucial. One of the things that's very neat in the Canadian system is when charters of the banks expire, now they expire every 5 years, they all expire at the same time. And you have to have a new act passed at that same time. So the Canadians have set up a system which is mandates updating constantly. It keeps the bankers on a short leash, and it also avoids the creation of a shadow banking system. Because as new activities and new ideas come up, they get brought under the blanket of the regulatory system. This is quite an interesting idea, and it seems to be quite relevant and important. Of course, it's in some sense just sort of epiphenomenal of the political equilibrium that's trying to do a good job at the regulatory problems. Another interesting thing is in the early 20th century in Canada, on two different occasions, I guess it was both of them were before 1910, the Bank of Montreal sees a bank failing, and it goes in and, on behalf of all the other large Canadian banks, takes over the bank before its failure is disruptive to the economy or before it's really noticed by anyone else. On other occasions, they didn't rescue banks when they didn't think they were systemically important. So notice, you don't have a central bank in Canada until 1935. You have no deposit insurance until decades after that, and yet you had a systemic risk manager happening through a cooperative process within the banking system. This is not really unusual. The Barings crisis was resolved in England in a very similar way in 1890. We could also point to examples of other branch banking systems that managed to do this sort of ad hoc crisis resolution in very interesting ways. So my point is that banking theories that don't take into account industrial organization and politics and how that can give rise to particular kinds of crisis mitigation or regulation are really missing fundamentally the kinds of influences that explain why potentially fragile environments don't necessarily become fragile.
Charles Gomez, thank you very much.
And thank you.